what are your top surprises for 2019 then?
The Fed doesn't raise rates at all. Market appreciates 15% from its opening.
We have signs from inside Apple that the iPhone sales aren't as strong as anticipated. We reported a few weeks ago that they had an internal quote-unquote fire drill, as one person at Apple described it.
There had been several signals going into this year that iPhone sales this quarter would not be as great as they have been in prior quarters. We've seen several suppliers cut their forecasts.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, with no talks about a recession to 2020, 2019 looks like it's shaping up, or could be, another good year for the economy. Apple cuts guidance, sending stocks into a steep swoon on Thursday, only to launch like a NASA space launch on Friday as the Fed goes soft at an economic conference. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in hour one will be Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Now, if you remember Craig from last October, another bullseye for Mr. Johnson. He said we'd probably touch 2,300 and then finish out the year at 2,500, which is exactly what happened. Well, he thinks that this current rally is a relief rally, and we could see a double bottom and another buying opportunity on the next dip. He likes energy stocks, consumer cyclicals, and technology, but he believes 2019, much like 2018, is going to be another trading environment. Also, later on in the program will be Dr. Frank Nothaf from CoreLogic. He sees a significant slowing in home price appreciation. We're going to take a look at some of the causes of that, including not only higher prices, but higher mortgage rates. We'll also take a look at, is this a good time to buy, wait, or sell based on current housing trends? And Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what was another volatile week on Wall Street. Talk about big swoons, down over 600 points on Thursday, only to rocket over 700 points on Friday. All of that coming up in hour one.
And in hour two, we're going to be airing our first big picture show of the year. And that's where Jim Poplava and myself will look at what the experts are predicting for 2019. Now, in that second hour, we look at everything from the stock market, interest rates, inflation, and my favorite part are the wild cards that may throw the economic ship off course. And as you'll hear, everyone on Wall Street seems to be gearing up for one last hurrah, unless the unexpected happens. So be sure to tune in for hour two, The Big Picture, Forecast 2019, The Last Hurrah. Now, moving on to this week, we closed the volatile market chapter of 2018 this week and started fresh with a market rally from oversold conditions. So let's welcome back Ryan Poplava to talk about the catalysts and drivers that moved the market this week.
Chris, the initial kick up came Monday off a tweet from President Trump Saturday that he had a very long and very good call with President Xi of China. Of course, you know, we've heard this sort of thing before, maybe 50 times. This was, of course, maybe a prequel to the mid-level trade meetings that are set to take place early next week. And if those go well, it's expected that the Chinese officials will come to the U.S. the following week. But expectations aren't all that high, as given that the trade rep, Robert Lighthizer, will lead the talks, and he's been a fairly big trade hawk and has been of the opinion we still need more tariffs to get China to come to the table or budge. But one last thing on this, the State Department issued a travel advisory just, I think, Thursday to U.S. citizens traveling to China, just due to arbitrary enforcement of local laws as they specified it. So we'll have to see if Trump is right, whether talks are long and very good. Monday and Tuesday next week, that'll be a major catalyst to follow up just ahead. But it was something that kind of kicked things off at the beginning of the week. Of course, we were off for January 1st and New Year's Day. But let's talk about some of the other major catalysts this week. The first I want to mention is the ISM manufacturing, the PMI data for China. China's manufacturing PMI printed a contraction reading. That's anything below 50 is a contraction. It came in at 49.4 for the first time since 2016, while services did go up. They went from 53.4 all the way up to 53.8. Not a huge big increase, but at least they went up. And Apple, that was another huge catalyst. Same day as the ISM manufacturing report came in for the US, both of those were kind of bearish catalysts on the day and why we traded down Thursday. But Apple cut its revenues. No real surprise there, right? All of the suppliers have been cutting in December, and that had led to some of the angst that investors were feeling in December. But it's the first such warning since 2002, Chris, and they blamed the bulk of it, of their revenue shortfall, came in their iPhone segment. And specifically, they said, from a large China, from China's retail slowdown. And so looking at the rest of their products, that they said that profits were up, revenues were up, I think 19% outside of iPhone sales. So this was something very specific, just tied to one thing. And of course, we all know at the end of their earnings call just last quarter, they mentioned that they will no longer be talking about individual shipping numbers. So no longer will they be giving that kind of forward-looking data. I kind of feel like it was old news. And I thought, a lot of this stuff has already been priced in the stock of Apple with all of the suppliers warning. Statistically, it's the first time they've done this since 2002. So that a bit of a shock factor there. Now, staying on the topic of manufacturing, with what happened with China, our manufacturing ISM data came out after the announcement of Apple overnight, and that kind of added to the kind of scare and concern that we have towards growth, especially out of China. And so when our ISM manufacturing data came in with a sizable drop, it went from the high 50s all the way down to 54. But that data actually corresponds with, I was looking at some of the reports of a 3.4% increase in real annualized GDP, according to ISM. So it's, we're still in growth mode, right? In the mid-50s, in the upper 50s and low 60s, that's typically where we've seen that data figure kind of stall. So this is pretty natural to see it come down here. But again, that's also pointing out that it's still solid growth at 3.4% annualized GDP. Where the most concern was on new orders, that dropped down significantly. And that was the big deal, because that's also a leading number towards future results there. Finally, let's talk about how things ended on Friday. First, out of the gate, futures were up substantially on the jobs report, showing growth of 312,000 jobs were added, with average hourly earnings up 0.4%. Now, that's a big increase for those. And both were faster than expected, while the unemployment rate did tick up to 3.9%, mainly due to a big increase in the labor force participation. Now, these were strong numbers, and they brought the probability of a rate cut in December down from 46% is where the Fed futures were counting on a cut this next December, and it brought it down from 46 down to 28. But what really set the tempo for the rest of the rally all day on Friday was reassuring comments from Fed Chairman Jerome Powell at the American Economic Association annual meeting. Now, this was a roundtable. It wasn't just Powell there. Of course, we had some huge heavyweights. We had Janet Yellen, former Fed chair, as well as Ben Bernanke, another Fed former chair. So investors picked up on some really key statements here that he made right off the bat. I think it was about like 5 minutes in to his conversation. He's talked about some really key things here. Let's see what that was.
Now, when we get conflicting signals, as is not infrequently the case, policy is very much about risk management. And I'll offer a couple of thoughts on that to wrap up. First, as always, there is no preset path for policy. And particularly with the muted inflation readings that we've seen coming in, we will be patient as we watch to see how the economy evolves. But we're always prepared to shift the stance of policy and to shift it significantly if necessary.
you know, that was really key. That key phrase, wanting to be patient. The market really picked up on that right then and there. And originally we were starting to correct when he was talking about how strong numbers have been. So it's like, oh yeah, here we go again. Strong numbers from Powell, not really listening to the market. But that's not what he said. He said, we have now the ability to be patient. So he further went on to emphasize that when we get contrasting signals from the market and strong data, policy is set on risk management. So again, kind of hitting on some really important factors that the investors wanted to hear in the December policy statement or from the conference that Jerome was listening to the market. And so we do have that here. Listen in.
As many of you will recall, in December 2015, when we lifted off from the zero lower bound, the median FOMC participant expected 4 rate increases for 2016. But very early in the year, in 2016, financial conditions tightened quite sharply, and under Janet's leadership, the committee nimbly, and I would say flexibly, adjusted our expected rate path. We did eventually raise rates a full year later in December 2016. Meanwhile, the economy weathered a soft patch in the first half of 2016 and then got back on track, and gradual policy normalization resumed. Now, no one knows whether this year will be like 2016, but what I do know is that we will be prepared to adjust policy quickly and flexibly and to use all of our tools to support the economy, should that be appropriate, to keep the expansion on track, to keep the labor market strong, and to keep inflation near 2%.
So I honestly think this was probably one of the best interviews I've seen from Jay Powell, where he acknowledged the weak ISM numbers, but he said most data has been strong. Wages are moving higher, but hasn't raised concerns over inflation. He was both reassuring as well as flexible, whereas previous comments back in September and in October, specifically October 3rd, he said, we're a long ways away from neutral on interest rates. And that communicated that the Fed was still set on a set path. Here, we don't see that. We see that he's listening to the market, wanting to, of course, be more data dependent. And that's where it looks like he's continuing to backpedal away from that kind of set path. And he did just essentially much to reverse that mentality, and that we have a more data-dependent Fed again is what I think the market wanted to hear.
Well, a very bullish end for the week, but we still will need to see this officially with the Fed minutes next week and their first meeting, which is set on January 29th and the 30th. So next week, out of the gates, we'll be hearing more on trade, another critical catalyst that is tugging on investor strings. So it should be another interesting week given how much volatility we've seen already in the past few weeks.
Yeah, Chris, it has been exciting. Pretty volatile, up 5% days like December 26th and another 4% here on Friday. It's been very interesting. It's a great trading environment if you're nimble. Consumer Electronics Show is going to kick off as well this Sunday with NVIDIA as the keynote. But here's some of the topics I was taking a look at. I think we should be expecting a lot concerning 5G. That's the fifth generation rollout in speed for wireless technology. And I think that's going to be the biggest hot topic. And, you know, I think companies are going to have to address how they are addressing 5G. Are they coming out with new products this year? What is the rollout going to look like? And then eventually also in 2020. Some of the other topics, we've got wellness technology, smart speakers, 8K TVs, self-driving cars, wireless charging, virtual reality, augmented reality, and bendy phones, I'm hearing. So it should be very interesting to see what the Consumer Electronics Show will be showing. You know, some real key products have been released in this throughout the year. So it's a major, major event. We'll also possibly hear some more pre-announcement behavior, as we won't see financials kick off earnings until January 14th and 18th. So more possible apples out there. Who knows? We'll have to see. So more to come. It should be an exciting month in the markets after an eventful December correction and rally.
And speaking of 5G, I wanted to mention that our January 3rd episode of FS Insider, Chris Sheridan interviews Woody Prusel at 13D Research. He discusses the accelerating arms race between China and the U.S. Over technology, but a lot of time is spent on 5G for our listeners that are interested in that topic. But Ryan, as always, we do want to thank you for your careful attention to the markets this last week, and we will look forward to hearing your report next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
5G is a key technology because it will link various other exponential technologies together. It's a next generation wireless. It's up to 100 times faster than 4G with virtually no latency. And so it creates a very highly reliable bandwidth communications link. And so in effect, 5G will connect AI and quantum computers in the cloud with the IoT and wireless sensors in the field. From the U.S. standpoint, primary concern has been the Made in China 2025 program, which is China's efforts to become a leader in many of these exponential technologies, such as AI and quantum computing. And so the controversy around Huawei is the twin issues of the rise of China's innovation economy and also national security implications.
Joining us on the show today is Craig Johnson, Chief Market Technician for Piper Jaffray, often referred to as Craig Bullseye Johnson, because once again, when we spoke with you, Craig, I think it was late October, it looked like the market was finding a bottom, and you said, no, you think the market still has lower to go, and you gave 2,500 to 2,350 as two important support lines that you were looking at for where we could go, and lo and behold, gosh, I mean, the almost the exact bottom late December was 2,350, so we hit that lower support line you're talking about. And we're just around the 2,500 region. We're now getting below that with the drawdown from Apple's weak guidance and citing China as being a factor as well. So that's obviously weighing on the market on the day that you and I are speaking. It's January 3rd. But Craig, let's get an update on what's going on. What's your diagnosis of the market as it stands today?
Well, thank you for the positive comments. And as we look at the market heading in here to, 2019, we titled our outlook for 2019, Corralling the Bull Market, as we believe that this market is going to essentially be stuck in a trading range. We think 2,500 on the lower end, 2,900 on the upper end, and we close the year somewhere around 2,725 on the S&P 500 for 2019. Now, looking at the shorter term price action that we've been seeing in the market here over the last several weeks, and specifically in here today, is we believe that we're getting some sort of relief rally. We think that this relief rally will probably extend maybe a little bit higher. Maybe we get back up toward about 2530, maybe 2580 on the S&P 500. Why did we choose those levels? Simplistically this. When we look at where the February lows were at, we thought the February lows were a spot where you could find support, but we thought ultimately it would break. Now that we've broken below those February lows of 2018, technically you typically see a relief rally that will come back up to what was support is now resistance at that 2530, 2580 range. I think that's going to be touched and probably further explored here in coming days and weeks, but ultimately, over the next month or so, we'll probably have to see this market sell off again back down toward that 2300, 2350-ish type range. And we'll probably put in some sort of double bottom low, similar fashion to what happened in 16 and also in 2011. So today's price action, I think, will probably be temporary. I was watching yesterday's price action, and we started out quite negative, and we were able to see the market move back to positive territory during the session. I suspect that today will be a little bit more difficult to do with the news that we've gotten from Apple. But nonetheless, I think the market will be able to move past the negative headlines and news from Apple, and we'll continue to be able to push a little bit higher here over the intermediate term.
Okay, so let's see if I got this correct. It sounds like you're looking for a short-term sell-off, or you're thinking that we will see another double dip, double bottom, similar to what we saw in 2011 and the 2015-2016 time period. But ultimately, after that happens, you are looking for the market to regain its footing. And so if I got the number right, I think you said 2775 for 2019 is the target you're looking at. Did I get that correct?
2725 for year end 2019. And that we're going to be in this range, we think, of about 2500 on the lower end and 2900 on the upper end.
Got it. Okay. So you're not seeing an end to the bull market. I mean, some people, if you want to take the bearish view, it would be that we saw a market peak in late September, early October, with the highs that we saw then. I believe if you look at it intraday from those highs to the lows that we saw late December, that was a 20% correction intraday on the S&P 500 and some other indices. But according to your outlook, it's not the end of the bull market.
I don't believe it's the end of the bull market. I think for this to really be the end of the bull market, what we're really going to need to see is an inversion of the yield curve, a recession unfold, something along those lines to really end the secular bull market that truly started, off the March lows of 2009 and was confirmed in 2013. I just view this as kind of a pause that ultimately refreshes. I don't think that this bull market is over yet.
Okay. So you were talking about how you think that we are going to see a double bottom low, similar to how we saw the market behave around the 2011 and then 2016 period with the February 2016 double bottom there. You know, in that case, what would you be saying for investors right now as it stands? Because, I mean, late December, we were extremely oversold. And I was just looking at some charts, some technical charts. In some cases, we haven't been this oversold since the market bottom of 2009. If you look at new 52-week lows, extremely, extremely oversold levels. So, you know, that bounce back that we saw after late December was kind of what you would expect. But at this point, it looks like you're looking for further digestion. So maybe we did see a good buying opportunity. You see another one happening with that double bottom if that plays out. So short term, look for another buying opportunity perhaps. But, you know, over the course of 2019, you know, it sounds like you're still thinking that you should be long on the market. So what are the investment implications given where we're at currently?
Yeah, so let me put a little bit, you know, finer detail on some of those points there. Just rolling back to early 2018, I remind the listeners that, you know, we raised our hand in mid-January of last year and said, time out. Stocks are going parabolic. They end one way, they end badly. And that's exactly what we've seen unfold. Now, fast forward to where we are now is this market, to your point, is very oversold. And on some of these tools that we have used for years, here at Piper Jaffray, namely our 40-week technique, which measures the percentage of our groups, of our group work that remains above their 40-week moving average, that has reached a level that we've only seen back in 2016 lows, we saw in the 11 lows, and typically when we see readings as low as they are right now with that gauge. And right now, the current reading is about 6%. 6% of our groups are above a 40-week moving average. Now, that's an extremely low reading. And when we've seen that reading this low, it's time to start leaning the other way. And to that point, we actually put about 5% of our cash back to work in our model portfolio. And just as a reminder, I can only be 25%. We went to 15% cash back in January. I just put about a third of it back to work right before the Christmas holidays when that reading got to the single digit levels. It's not a perfect indicator in terms of the day, but when you look back at history, it kind of gets it right over a multi-week period of time. And we saw that big rally start to unfold. Still think it's a relief rally. And I'd still say to people, we want to be starting to put money back to work on these pullbacks. Because again, I've only seen this indicator that I'm talking about here go to zero three times in history. In 08 and 09, 73-74 oil crisis, and the 87 market crash. I haven't found a single investor out there that thinks that either of those three scenarios are likely at this point in time. So that means we need to be buying equities for the move back the other direction, because it is in such an extreme move at this point in time.
Okay, perfect. So thank you for clarifying that. The percentage groups above the 40-week average is very low at 6%. When it gets down to that level, you want to start leaning the other way and be deploying cash. So, you know, take out your shopping list. But then again, you do think that this is a relief rally. So another short-term dip may be in the offing again.
Which will be your opportunity to put the cash back to work on that next short-term dip. So we put some of it to work on the first kind of what we thought was a capitulation first low. We're seeing the relief rally coming back up. We're repositioning how we want to on that relief rally. And then on this next move down is when we're going to be probably putting the rest of our cash back to work in a series of moves, not all at once, but in a series of moves, as we think that that secondary low gets ultimately set and confirms the intermediate term low for the overall market, which again, we think happens in weeks. I'll just remind you, when I go back to 16, it took about 16 days to make that secondary low. In 2011, it took about 36 days. So what I've been saying to the institutions is somewhere in the next several weeks to a month, you'll get that secondary low made. And that's where we want to be putting money back to work, during that pullback for that secondary low.
So Craig, I believe you're a CFA and a CMT, if I have that correct. So you're a technician and a financial analyst. So you've got two different ways of looking at the market: fundamentals, strategy, and then also technicals. We covered the technicals here. Let's talk a little bit about the fundamentals and maybe some of the sectors that you're enjoying. You know, if you think about value and where people should be deploying their cash on that next buying opportunity. What's your take given the macro backdrop?
Sure. So investors had not been questioning the fundamentals of this market. It seemed like the economy in the U.S. was doing well. Yes, there's questions about the growth in Europe at this point in time. And the U.S. continues to be the best place to put money back to work. If we look at the fact that there's still expectations for multiple rate hikes to come in 2019, I would suspect that that is going to mean additional challenges for the emerging markets at this point in time. Further rate hikes, strengthening dollar would, I think, continue to keep those emerging markets in somewhat of a weak position, at least for now. From an individual sector perspective, if I go back and use history as a bit of a guide, coming off the lows you had seen certainly in 16, it wasn't a growth rally that led off those lows. In fact, if you think back to some of these kind of lows that have been made, like in 16, lows that were made in 11, and then certainly the lows made in 08 and 09, there was one common phrase that I heard from a lot of people. This is a quote-unquote garbage rally, meaning that all these stocks that people thought that were going to go out of business sprung back very, very quickly. And those were the names where you saw substantial returns and returns that were much higher than what you got with your typical growth companies. I would not expect this to be any different this time. In fact, if I got to go through and say, where are some of the more beaten up areas of the market, I'd come back and say, let's take a look at the energy stocks. That has been among the most beaten up areas that probably is a little bit overdone at this point in time. So from my perspective, going back and looking at history, I would think some of these energy names might actually do fairly well coming out of any sort of downturn from here. I'd also say from a sector level perspective, the consumers. I continue to see interesting looking charts in consumer land, specifically in the consumer cyclicals. And I continue to see interesting looking charts in tech, despite the weakness that you're seeing in Apple at this point in time. So those are some of the areas of emphasis for us at this point.
Okay. So energy stocks at the sector level, consumer cyclicals, even technology. So, you know, Apple, again, dragging down the market on the day that you and I are speaking with his weak guidance and then citing China as being a problem as well. But from your vantage point, you know, tech is still a good, what would you say, a long-term hold? What's your view on tech?
I would summarize tech as this, and then I'll talk about Apple. But I'd summarize tech as simply this. Tech is where the growth and innovation is happening. And when I think about the U.S. and why the U.S. still continues to be among the markets of choice for most investors around the world, is we have an Apple, we have a Microsoft, We have an Adobe. We have an Oracle. We have a lot of these companies that have been growth and innovation leaders for decades. And I don't see that changing. Unfortunately for Europe, they don't have that same kind of favorable mix. They don't have as many technology companies that are global in, leaders in technology. They don't. They've got more financial companies. They've got more industrial companies. And those don't tend to be quite as growthy as what you're seeing here in the U.S. Now, in terms of Apple, yeah, Apple's off, I think right now, about 7, 8% from yesterday's close. It's well off the highs that the stock has been at. But I got to step back and remind people, Apple still has almost a 1.9% dividend yield. Apple is trading at about 6 times next year's numbers. I get it. The iPhone numbers were disappointing. I get it. You had to reset there in expectations. But I wouldn't get too carried away thinking that Apple is now becoming the next Dell computer or the Microsoft Wintel cycle is starting to play out in the handset space. I think there's a lot more innovation still there to be had with Apple. And I think this is just a kind of a temporary setback. And in fact, we did add Apple into our model portfolio just before the Christmas holidays when we chose to put some of our money back to work, because I do think this is a great company, buying back a lot of stock, still very good earnings. I think it's kind of like ballast in a portfolio for investors that want to have technology exposure.
Okay. Craig, now, one thing I think that's on the minds of a lot of different investors and strategists is what the Fed is going to do in 2019. And as you said, you think further hikes will continue, that this will strengthen the dollar, it'll put pressure on emerging markets. Some are thinking, hey, maybe the Fed will actually pause or at least lower the forecast and number of the rate hikes. They did that late last year, right? So they said that we've gone, I believe it was from 3 rate hikes that are expected in 2019 down to 2. And that wasn't quite dovish enough. People wanted to see some movement on the balance sheet area on quantitative tightening, right? Wanted to see at least some comments along the lines of, hey, with the big market drawdown, perhaps we're not going to tighten as quickly, right? That they didn't say anything along those lines. So people are looking now for the January meeting as a place where Fed Chair Jay Powell may communicate some of these things. So a lot of unknowns here, a lot of variables when it comes to the Fed. But it sounds like you do think further rate hikes are going to continue. It doesn't look like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't look like you're thinking that there's a chance that they're going to pause here.
As I look out to the Fed and I look at some of the, you know, the forward rates and, you know, the probabilities for hikes and cuts, et cetera, their stated objective was there's going to be 2 more increases in 2019. That's your stated objective. When you look at the bond market, it's starting to question some of those potential 2 additional rate hikes. I don't think the Fed is going to do anything in January. I think if they were to do anything, it would be perhaps in a June meeting or perhaps in a fall meeting at this point. But right now, that's their stated objective. They've talked about 2 additional rate hikes on their roadmap. And I know a lot of investors are questioning it at this point. But I would just come back and just remind people that there needs to be some ability to put some of the very accommodative dollars and back to work or take that off the table so that if there is to be a recession in the future, that the Fed does have something that they can do in terms of lowering rates in the future. But right now, that's their roadmap. That's what they're talking about. The bond market doesn't believe it when I look at the forward future curves for Fed funds, and they are suggesting less. What I find kind of interesting from an investor perspective, though, is that investors seem to think that they can call it chirping, and basically seem to think that the Fed is going to be listening and simply that it's going to alter the Fed's path. And it just seems like we've gotten into a market where a lot of investors seem to think that they can go out and start to chirp and the Fed is immediately going to turn around and change course with what they've been doing before. I mean, this to me is one of these syndromes where everybody needs to get a trophy. And I disagree with that scenario. The Fed needs to do what the Fed needs to do to provide what they believe is the best course of action And just because the market is down does not mean that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, keep in mind that we've gone 38 years since 1980. We've now only had 7 down years. I think where expectations need to get reset is really investors' expectations. This is not an annuity. I mean, the market will have positives, the market will have negatives, and you will get some of these downturns that will occur. But I don't think the Fed should be altering their path for simply saying, oh, the market's down, we got to alter our path. They got to do the right thing for the broader economy. And when they're looking out 18 to 24 months down the road, reacting to short-term downturns in the market, I don't think is what's on their is on their roadmap to go do.
Mm, okay. So some of the calls that we've been seeing by big-name strategists that the Fed's going to make a big mistake and is ignoring the data, you think that that's maybe a little bit too hyped or sensational at this point?
I think it's probably a little bit overdone. I think that, you know, again, just because the market was down here in the States, mid-single digits for the year in 2018, does not create all of a sudden a panic that we immediately have to put more liquidity in the system.
Right.
I mean, when I look around the world and I look at what's happened in the Shanghai composite, and I look at what's happened in most of the indexes over in Europe, they're down mid-teens to 20%. Again, we're down mid-single digits. I just think expectations have gotten to be a little bit out of sync with reality. And just because the market is down does not mean that the Fed has to immediately change course and alter their plans for where they believe the economy should be from a tightening and easing perspective. I think there needs to be a resetting of investors' expectations.
It seems like investors just got used to having such a good time in the market. I mean, you think about 2017, it was a straight-up affair, almost no volatility. So like you said, yeah, I mean, if that's what you're expecting and that's what you become conditioned to, a little bit volatility in the market like we've seen late 2018, you know, it probably just, people just aren't used to it. And so resetting of expectations sounds about right. Craig, last question I want to ask you is, do you have a forecast for a recession here in the U.S. at all?
I'm not forecasting a recession for the U.S. at this point in time. If the 2 to 10 curve does finally invert, and by the way, I'll tell you, over the last week or so, it's actually been steepening. But when the Fed curve does invert, then let's talk about that. But at this point in time, I'm not in the recessionary camp. And then if I just add one other thing in here, too, for the listeners to think about is, so many listeners have been thinking about all these passive investments over time. And they've been terrific vehicles, low-cost vehicles, et cetera. But we got to come back and step back and think about how much of our money should be run passive and how much of it should be run active. Mm. Because if I'm right for 2019, and certainly it played out a lot of volatility in 2018, but we're probably going to have to trade stocks a little bit more, move things around a little bit more than just buying and holding like we have seen through the passive year of 2017. And if that is indeed the case, we're going to have to be more active, and active managers are probably going to have a little bit of an upper hand than the passive folks in 2019. Just food for thought.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great comment to leave with our listeners. And just to summarize, you are thinking that we're going to see another double dip in the market, so we haven't probably seen the ultimate lows, but we are getting definitely close to that point. And one of the things you're looking at is your 40-week average. We're at very low levels, so you're seeing that as another buying opportunity if we do get that double dip and see further weakness, start pulling cash in some of those areas that you're looking at. The sectors you like, energy stocks, consumer cyclicals, you still like tech, and you're not forecasting a recession. That's not something you're going to be willing to really discuss until we see an inversion of the yield curve. And I mean, if you look at past cycles, we've seen multiple inversions before a final recession. So even if we do see one, it doesn't mean that the recession is here, you know, if you just look at the data. But that being said, it sounds like that's your outlook with, you know, a low of around 2,500 to upper range of 2,900 on the S&P 500 for 2019. Did I get all that right?
You summed it up perfectly.
All right. Well, Craig, it is always a pleasure to have you on our show on Financial Sense NewsHour. Once again, we have nicknamed you Craig Bullseye Johnson because of how many times
your targets have been hit. And again, I want to give you kudos for just the amazing forecast that you gave when we spoke to you in October, saying that the market was going to head lower. And you said 2350, 2500 was the target support levels you're looking at. And we bottomed at 2350. So amazing call once again. Keep up the great work. And we look forward to speaking with you on our program and the future.
Thanks.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Another chart that we can look at is the percent of members with new 52-week highs or lows. And so we have both of these indicators shown with the S&P 500. Again, the most oversold conditions that we have seen since the market bottomed in 2009. So we have never, ever seen this number of new 52-week lows in the market unless we go all the way back to 2009. So that just gives you an idea of how momentous this 2018 bear market that we saw was. The housing market has been seeing some slowing in different parts of the U.S., many people thinking that this could be the start of a longer slowdown that could last for another year or two or so. There's a lot of variables at play, and to discuss the variables in question with us on today's podcast is Dr. Frank Notaft. He is the chief economist at CoreLogic. Frank, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me today, Chris.
Yeah, so Frank, I was looking at the recent data on CoreLogic talking about increasing slowdown, and I guess what we should say is that it's the rate of acceleration of home prices that's slowing. We're not seeing anything like what we saw after 2005, right? But we are seeing a slowdown in the rate at which home prices are increasing. So I think at the latest data point, if I remember correctly, was covering from November to this November, I believe, year over year, and it was looking at around 5%, if I have that correct. Give us an idea. What are we seeing in the housing market, and are you concerned about the outlook going forward?
And you're absolutely right. We've seen a significant deceleration in the rate of home price growth. So in our national CoreLogic home price index, prices are up 5.1% November to November. And that's a significant slowing. For example, back in the spring, in March of 2018, nationally, home prices were up 6.7%. So we've already seen a dramatic slowing in home price growth, and I expect home price growth to slow further in 2019. And the slowdown in home prices hasn't been uniform. It's affected some areas of the country more severely, and there are some communities that have actually seen a home price dip, a decline over the last 12 months. So even though our national index is up 5.1%, that doesn't mean each and every single community, each and every single house is up in value by 5.1%. It's uneven. Some places have seen a double-digit increase in home prices, and there are other places, other communities that have actually seen prices decline.
Now, would you just say that this is a natural kind of rhythm that we see with cycles, everything in the market cycles, the economy, the market, ups and downs? Is that what you see taking place currently? Is this just now more of a consolidation and giving back some of those strong gains that you said that we saw, you know, in prior years? Or is this something bigger that we should be worried about?
I think it's a response to a lack of affordability. So with home prices rising and now with mortgage interest rates rising, the affordability to buy homes has eroded significantly over the last couple of years. For example, we've seen home prices up 5.1% over the last 12 months in our national index. At the same time, mortgage rates are up about a percentage point. If you combine those two factors together, that means to buy the same identical house now compared with 1 year ago, everything else the same, the monthly principal and interest payment is 18% higher today compared with 1 year ago to buy the identical house. The only thing that's changed is that home prices are up 5% and mortgage interest rates are up a percentage point.
Ah, okay. So that's a really interesting statistic and way to think about it. To buy that same identical house now as it was a year ago, your monthly interest payment is going to be quite a bit bigger. So affordability, that's playing a role. Mortgage rates are playing a role. So in that case, I mean, you just think about it, straight economics, right? You're a chief economist. If the fundamentals are no longer justifying that payment, prices have to come down for people to buy that house. So you said 2019, you do expect housing prices to then deteriorate further from here.
To have more slowing. So again, we're over the next year, we are forecasting home prices to continue to rise, but to rise at a slower pace than what we've seen each of the last several years. So I think house price growth will be less than 5% pretty clearly in 2019 in our national index. The way the affordability erosion starts to impact housing demand is that there are potential home buyers who, you know, because of higher interest rates and higher prices, they say, well, gee, maybe I'll pause. I'll wait for a little while before I look to buy a home. And then home sellers then observe that the home that they've listed for sale, it's suddenly not transacting. It's staying on the market for an extended period of time and not selling. And so a home seller then usually starts to cut the list price. And as they cut the list price, then that increases the likelihood that they'll be able to match a deal with a buyer and lead to a transaction. But that process of cutting the list price in order to consummate and make a sale results in a slowing in home price growth in our index as well as other indexes. And that's how, what I think will play out in the coming year. We'll see a slowing in home price growth. Prices will still be up in most communities, but at a slower pace than what we've seen the last few years.
Okay, yeah, and thank you for that clarification, because I said a deterioration in home prices. To repeat, as you just stated, it's not that you're seeing a deterioration in home prices from current levels. It's just the rate of price growth is slowing. And the forecast that CoreLogic has is that will likely be less than 5% in 2019. So, I mean, if you're talking about just under 5% for home price appreciation, that's still not that bad. I mean, if you're in the 4% range, you know, that's decent by some standards.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right. That's still decent. What it does mean is that there will be more communities that will see prices probably not rising and maybe even dipping, even though the national index is up, say, 4% in 2019. So most people, most homeowners will see some, you know, pretty good home price growth greater than inflation, but not everybody. Some homeowners will see that the value of their home really hasn't changed or maybe has declined over the last year. So that's likely what we'll experience in the coming year. And of course, it depends what happens also with interest rates over the course of 2019.
Okay, and that would definitely be my next question I'd like to transition into. Trump has been putting a lot of heat on the Federal Reserve, on Fed Chairman Jay Powell, about his persistence in raising interest rates. You know, he believes that the Fed is going to squash the recovery and put us into another recession. And I think, as many of our listeners know, and you might probably know this as well, the Fed had bought up a lot of mortgage-backed securities that had become troubled after the 2005 bubble, and we saw all the problems emerge in 2008. And they're allowing those to roll off their balance sheet. And so we are seeing mortgage interest rates start to tick up. As you mentioned, that's having an impact. So let's talk about the interest rate impact. Is this is a primary area, I think, that is affecting the housing market. So what is your outlook in terms of further impacts from interest rates on housing?
Well, I do expect the Federal Reserve to continue to increase short-term interest rates during 2019. As you know, Chris, in December of 2018, the Fed raised the federal funds target another 0.25 percentage point, and it stands now at a target range of 2.25% to 2.5%. And I do expect that over the course of 2019, we'll see the Fed increase that federal funds target further. I think at least two more times and possibly three times by quarter percentage point increment between now and the end of 2019. So that would put the upper range of the federal funds target at 3% or a little bit above. Now, with short-term interest rates rising, that's going to increase the interest rates for homeowners who have an adjustable rate mortgage or planning to get an adjustable rate mortgage, or who have a home equity line of credit, because most home equity lines of credit are indexed to short-term interest rates. It also will affect long-term interest rates as well. But I don't think 30-year fixed rate mortgage rates are going to go up as much as short-term interest rates. In our forecast, we have fixed rate mortgage rates gradually rising over the course of 2019, and somewhere in the second half of the year, toward the end of 2019, they'll be crossing 5% and will be above 5%. Right now, they're below 5%. But I do see mortgage rates rising more for adjustable rate mortgages and home equity lines of credit, but also rising for 30-year fixed rate mortgages over the course of 2019.
Yeah, when you talk about the level or the pace at which mortgage interest rates rise, I mean, a lot of this goes back to inflation expectations, right? Because if we're thinking about 10-year yields, the market is pricing in how fast we're going to see inflation and the compensation that we have to see based on that. So if we were to see runaway inflation, perhaps, you know, I don't think that that is too likely. But if we were to see that, then we should expect to see mortgage rates, 10-year rates climb higher because of that. But if inflation remains subdued, as we've been in this sort of low inflationary environment for quite a while, for a number of reasons, demographics, technology, take your pick, then in that case, probably shouldn't expect mortgage rates to climb as high. Would you say that that's a fair assessment?
Oh, that's very fair. It's really long-term inflationary expectations that affect long-term yields in the capital markets. Whether we're looking at 10-year treasury bond yields or we're looking at 30-year fixed rate mortgage rates, they're going to be affected by long-term inflationary expectations. That's one reason the Fed is so focused on its inflation targets over time. They want to make sure the inflation genie stays in the bottle. They don't want to uncork inflation and have expectations of investors, consumers, businesses suddenly become delinked from that 2% target goal that the Fed has established as consistent with price stability in the long term. If inflation expectations suddenly rise significantly above that, if they go to 3 or 4% or higher, then that does mean that long-term interest rates will have to be much higher. And with that will be much higher 30-year fixed rate mortgage rates. But I agree with you, Chris. I don't see the inflation accelerating over the course of the next couple of years. And in my mind, it is an important component of why the Fed has chosen to increase the federal funds target. The Fed still considers monetary policy as being accommodative, helping to promote economic growth. And so they've settled on this gradual transition, gradually raising short-term interest rates in order to reduce the amount of accommodation coming from monetary policy and to make sure that inflationary expectations remain centered at that 2% target longer term.
Yeah, and another component to this too, which is pretty interesting, and we've seen some pretty big movements in this space over just the past days or even weeks, is when we look at currencies abroad, you know, if we look at, for example, in Germany, or if we look at the Japanese yen, if we think about the euro, they have been weak and appear to be getting weaker while the US dollar continues to strengthen. And so that's also putting a lid
on inflation. So there's a number of things here that, you know, I think we'd have to see some pretty significant trend reversals to get worried at this point about runaway inflation and much higher yields than where we're at currently. So, you know, I guess bringing this back to housing again, the two main forces that you discussed in the beginning that are slowing home price appreciation are affordability, and a big part of that is the fact that we're seeing mortgage rates move up, and that prices are still out of range for many first-time home buyers, millennials, for example. I guess the thing is we want to see those prices come down. We want to see the pace of home price appreciation slow to the point where new home buyers can come in and buy at reasonable values. We're not there yet, so that's why you do have an expectation for continued depreciation in 2019 for the rate of home price growth in 2019. Any further out beyond that you can, you know, forecast, or is it still just a remains to be seen at this point?
Well, I do expect house price growth to slow further in 2020. I think it's unreasonable to expect home price growth to consistently exceed inflation year after year after year after year. So longer term, my view is that home price growth in our national index will continue to gradually moderate even into 2020 as well. It gets hard to make projections beyond that because, you know, a lot of economists do think that a recession will happen at some point. And it's not clear whether it could be as soon as 2020 or it'll be 2021 or beyond. But at some point, a recession will happen. And a recession then, of course, has significant impacts on the broader economy, but certainly on the housing market too. One important way to address affordability is to see consistent and steady income growth. And we're beginning to see that in the economy right now. As you know, the unemployment rate nationwide is at a 49-year low. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it go even lower here in early 2019. But with unemployment at a 49-year low and labor markets being relatively tight, that should translate into a pickup in income growth. And in the most recent wage tracker published by the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank, they're showing wages up roughly about 3.5% on a year-over-year basis. So as income starts to grow and grow a bit more rapidly, that provides the financial wherewithal for millennials and other families looking to buy to be able to afford to buy. So that's one way to address the affordability pinch that is affecting family budgets. There's a second way, and that is if we have a significant increase in single-family construction. So if we have more homes being built and supplied in the market, that will work to reduce home price pressures. It'll also work to reduce just the overall cost of shelter, because some of those units that are built will also be available in the rental market. So that'll work to help slow home price growth. It'll also work to help slow rent growth over time as well.
Dr. Frank Nodaff, wrapping things up, if this sounds about right, it sounds like in the short term, let's say for 2019 and possibly even to 2020, you expect home price growth to continue slowing. So, you know, if you're considering buying right now, you should keep that in mind, that you're probably going to see home prices to continue to slow. It's not probably the best time to buy unless you're thinking more over the long term, right? So if you're thinking, you know, if I'm going to be in this place for a long time, out several years or more, then that's okay. However, if you're trying to look for that sweet spot, would you say, you know, maybe waiting until the next recession is a good idea?
Well, if you want to wait that long, what I would advise a family is that if they've put their financial house in order, that is, they've made sure they've got sufficient funds in their savings accounts so they can afford the down payment, closing costs, and have something still left for a rainy day. So if they've taken those steps to make sure they've got sufficient financial reserves, have sufficient income to comfortably afford the mortgage payment, have taken steps to make sure that their credit score is as good as possible, then they're probably well positioned to, you know, think about buying a home. And what's important is to shop around. Don't just buy the first home you see. Shop around, get to know the neighborhoods, the communities, find where you really want to be, where you want to live. And then then you're ready, in case a home comes up that meets your budget, meets your needs, has the amenities in it that you want, then certainly you should really consider buying it today, because you don't know if it's going to be there tomorrow. You don't know if it's going to be there when the next recession hits.
One last question that I'd like to ask you, Frank, is on the flip side, let's say that you own a home and you want to sell. You've been looking to sell and perhaps you didn't sell when you originally wanted to, maybe a few years back. At this point, would you say, you know, time is kind of the essence if home price, you know, growth is going to continue to slow into this year and for 2020 as well?
Sure. And again, it depends on, you know, again, the situation for the individual home seller, but this is certainly a good time to have their home listed for sale on the marketplace, especially if our interest rate outlook is correct and interest rates are going to be higher a year from now than they are today. You'll find more home buyers who are potentially able to buy now or in the spring home buying season in 2019 than will be the case in spring of 2020. So if you are considering to sell, and if this is a right time for you, by all means, you should list your home for sale now. It could just become more challenging a year from now if it turns out that mortgage rates do rise, as I expect them to do.
Well, Frank, I want to thank you for coming on to Financial Sense News Hour, giving us an update on the housing market and how this relates to affordability, interest rates, and some of the implications for people that are either holding houses or want to buy a home as well. All the best to you. We look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Chris. Thanks for having me today, and have a great new year.
All right, same to you. It was a pleasure.
And in hour two, we're going to be airing our first big picture show of the year. And that's where Jim Poplava and myself will look at what the experts are predicting for 2019. Now, in that second hour, we look at everything from the stock market, interest rates, inflation, and my favorite part are the wild cards that may throw the economic ship off course. And as you'll hear, everyone on Wall Street seems to be gearing up for one last hurrah, unless the unexpected happens. So be sure to tune in for hour two, The Big Picture, Forecast 2019, The Last Hurrah.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.